Hello, and welcome back to Album with me, Arslan Mohammed. And it's a warm welcome back to one of our favourite guests, author of Black Star Trilogy, director of the Visconti Studio at Kingston University, professor of music, recording artist, convener of the Stylophone Orchestra. You know what? Just look at her site, leocardos.com. She does so much that I'd be here all day if I was to list her manifold achievements. But Leah and I are gathered here today to celebrate one of the most underrated records in the canon, Tin Machine 2. A work that typically gets overlooked, undersung, and generally snubbed by the cognoscenti. I know that actually many of you have a real soft spot for this 1991 follow-up to Tin Machine's debut. Assembled between 1989 and 1991, mainly in Australia, while Tin Machine Singer was often his Sound and Vision global jaunt of 1990, this final Tin Machine studio album hits you with its depths and its textured structures. Much more so than the debut, it offers up some really strong songwriting and really, really wonderfully experimental sounds, courtesy of course, Reeves Gabrels. But upon its release in September 1991, and despite the high-profile Sound and Vision tour and well-received Bowie reissues and hits packages, it seemed that the general public was still not in the mood for Tin Machine, despite all Bowie's exhortations in the media that this band was going places. Sadly, after the supporting tour, the only place the band seemed to be going were their own separate ways. But over the course of the following episodes, Leah and I are going back, we're going home, we're going stateside. Well, not really, but we're going to compare notes about this eccentric oddity of an LP. We're going to luxuriate in all its grinding, thrilling, occasionally exasperating glory. So, listeners, fire up the faders and let's enter Tin Machine 2.
If it hadn't been for this request, I wouldn't have listened to Tin Machine 2. And if it hadn't been for Nick asking to do Tonight, I wouldn't have listened to Tonight and actually grown to quite like it.
Yeah.
Do you really think Tin Machine 2 is a lost classic?
Hell yeah, I do. Yes, I'm willing to stake my reputation on it. It's out of print. I think it should be in print. I think we should start the campaign to get it back on, at least on streaming, and not YouTube, but, you know, proper streaming. It's got some really good songs on it. It's also funny. It's got some hilarious Bowie-isms on it, which just tickle me to this day. This album gives me so much joy. And it actually, it kind of rocks. You know, there's some good rock music on here. These guys are a good nasty garage band, and I think they sound the best here. That's my opinion. I also really kind of like, just as a subject, just to think about, is Bowie in this period. You know, it's such a strange time in his career where he's, you know, I think he's just finished the Linguini incident and he's off on tour doing a greatest hits. He's put the Ryko disc box set has just, you know, been put out, which is amazing. He's doing the thing he never said he would do, which is the Greatest Hits tour, and that's doing quite well. And then he's just met Iman. His life's turned upside down.
When did he meet Iman?
We're thinking like 1991. 1989 was when they started recording this in Sydney.
Yes.
And then they took a break. There was a Sound and Vision tour in between that. Oh, yeah, and I think he met Iman like in 1990, so before before they came and finished this off and before the It's My Life tour, for sure.
So in this, during the course of this album, the recording of it, like you say, was actually staggered over quite a long time. And over the course of that time, a couple of quite seismic things happened. So of course, he went on a massive May to September tour doing the greatest hits, something that he was really just going through the motions doing. I've got an interview with him from shortly after that where he was basically just saying, you know, I was offered that much cash. Well, of course, you'd be stupid not to.
He's feeling to do things.
Yeah, exactly. You know, he's probably quite burned by the reaction to Tin Machine 1. But he's kind of committed to this project. He goes around the world doing sound and vision. He's off to do Linguini Incident, and he meets Iman.
Yeah.
And then he comes back and continues the album.
Yeah. And it's like, I think the last time we were talking about the next day. Yes. And that was like the longest, you know, bun in the oven that Bowie had ever had in terms of an album. This one comes close.
It does,
in terms
it?
Of how long it was in development for. Really, and there's these storylines of like Reeves was the one that was really just working on it, like flying about doing a gazillion guitar overdubs. I think it's really funny the way it all came together in this peculiar time in Bowie's life. And also, you know, immediately after, like going straight from this to Nile Rodgers, like within months to start working on Black Tie, White Noise. I mean, what whiplash.
That's something else that's extraordinary, is that, I mean, obviously we'll get to the end of the album, but the direction he could have taken after this was when, you know, Nick Pegg's little chestnut about each Bowie album contains the seeds of the next project.
Yes.
And this is one where I don't quite hear that. I do hear, you know, maybe slight inflections leaning towards Heathen or Earthling or Hours, but not Black Tie, White Noise. You know, that progression.
I'm trying to think of a vector. Like, the cheesiest song on Tin Machine 2 is You Can't Talk, and maybe that could be like a kind of Lucy Can't Dance thing.
Yeah.
But maybe the stronger connection is Mr. Ed straight to Buddha of Suburbia. Like, maybe that's more like it. Or jumping from Baby Universal to One Outside. And
those are really intriguing comparisons. Of course, we can't forget Buddha of Suburbia, which comes shortly after this.
So no. And again, what a random thing. Like, he's doing so many different things in this period.
Yeah.
Just crazy.
Yeah. There's a sense that the Tin Machine 2 album is tainted by the very dint of it being a Tin Machine project. You know, when you talk about this album with Bowie fans, and there's often a sense of like, God, if only Tony Visconti was producing it, or only if it was branded a Bowie album, can you imagine how differently it might have been perceived, especially with the stronger songwriting going on here?
Wait, stronger and worse. I mean, there's a balance. What's interesting about the album is that Bowie's not on it. His face doesn't appear. On the artwork, I've got the vinyl here. This is the reissue.
Whoa. This is the reissue that came out in 2020, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Has this got the genitalia on it, or has it been airbrushed?
It's got the four dicks.
Oh, it's got the four dicks. Okay.
That's them. That's the boys. And even in the artwork inside, it's just the back of his head. That a famous shot on the back of it was just the back of his head. So it's interesting.
It's artwork. There's a funny parallel here, because the artwork is by Edward Bell, isn't it?
Yes, so Scary Monsters.
Mr.
Fame.
Scary Monsters.
Yes, exactly. Mr. Scary Monsters. I mean, but also on the text at the back, and I think this reflects the actual album, doesn't have Bowie's name. It has produced by Tin Machine, mixed by Tin Machine. So the word Bowie doesn't appear, which I think is interesting.
Do you ascribe a deliberate significance to that, or
is it? I don't know. The question is, you know, is he really that wedded to the idea of being this collective band identity, or is he embarrassed to put his name to it, or is he already moved on? Is he already checked out? Is he trying to sweep it under the rug because he's got Nile lined up, and that's what's next? I don't know.
I think any one of those theories could hold water. The sense I was getting, it's certainly in the media you see him doing for Tin Machine 2, is that he has got a foot out of the door. You know, he's not kind of doubling down on the next Tin Machine studio album, for instance. He's not talking it up as enthusiastically. I've got an old Q magazine promoting Sound and Vision, and he's very positive about Tin Machine there. But then, of course, he's busy sort of getting through Sound and Vision. So he's, in the interview, he's sort of alluding to the perfunctory nature of the Sound and Vision tour. It's an obligation. It's something I've got to do. I've got to clear the decks. I've got to get back to Tin Machine. You know, that's the exciting thing. But when it comes to promoting Tin Machine 2, it's almost again like, well, here's Tin Machine 2, but I've got to get onto the next thing now.
Yeah, and it could be a bit of that impatience. But it could be just emotionally checked out. I mean, sometimes you look at those bootlegs. That's all I've got. I never got to see them live. But he's just sort of, you know, the songs go for 12 minutes and he jumps off the stage to have a fag. And you're like, okay, is it really like a band thing? Like, is he just one of four? Is he just a quarter member? You know, is he, one of the collective, in which case it really isn't the Bowie show. It's something else.
It's really hard to tell. I was reading this new book about Paul McCartney and Wings and McCartney Legacy, which is fantastic. And it really unearthed something that hadn't occurred to me before, was the fundamental flaw of Wings was that Paul McCartney frantically wanted it to be a democracy. He told everyone it was a democracy. He wanted it all to be a democracy. But there's a bunch of session musicians going, well, that's Paul McCartney.
Yeah.
What are you going to do? You're a jobbing musician. And this guy's like, okay, give me your ideas. And you're like, well, no, you're Paul McCartney. So, I mean, to an extent, there was a similar dynamic going on here, wasn't there?
There must have been. It must have been impossible for the critics at the time, audiences, for anyone to not see this as a Bowie project with a backing band. And it's hard for, you know, for me as a fan and a scholar to go back to it and see it as something else separate from the catalogue. I see it definitely as a part of his oeuvre. And, his charisma and star wattage is just too overpowering, I think, for the context.
But do you feel, I mean, in the last few days I've been watching old YouTube clips and interviews and things, and do you feel he consciously changed his persona around this time? Because, you know, when you get Laddish Dave out, you're coming out now. I saw something, and some of it really is toe-curling. I mean, there's the famous appearance on BBC's Wogan.
Oh, the Wogan.
Wogan interview, and where I found a quote from Wogan's autobiography where he just said he was about to punch Bowie in the face because he was being such a dick.
Evening, Ron.
The guy who's fronting, is he okay?
Yes, he is. It's this man, right? You mean?
Yeah, yes.
Reeves.
Hi, Reeves. Reeves, good Cabral. To see you, yeah. Because he was playing it didn't look like a real guitar he was playing. I suppose that's not a real guitar he had.
Well, I don't. Yes, it was a real guitar.
We lunch, Terry.
Did you lunch?
Yes.
Look, how are you all getting on? Is it all working out all right, Tin Machine?
We have colour problems.
Yeah, I thought it was just me.
Between your tie and his jacket, and I have to keep these on.
It's new. It's new for us anyway to see you part of a band rather than just fronting a big spectacular.
Yeah, yeah.
Why did you decide to do it?
It gives me a new insight into washing habits.
You all share the same shower, do you?
No.
That's not.
Same laundry
mat. Then you had various, you know, like top pop European shows where some poor presenter is gamely trying to get the guys to cooperate, and they're all deadpanning and taking the piss, and, you know, Bowie's being elliptical and weird. And it's almost like he's being willfully difficult because he's the guy in the band. He's not Cheery Dave.
Episode number one rock show. I'd like to hear it for four special guests. They're here. Tin Machine. Let's kick off talking about the album,
yes.
Tin Machine 2. When I heard it, I went like, it sounds more like a studio album than the former one. You had more time in the studio to make this one.
The other
one
was done in a field.
Done in a field.
The first album we did in a field.
With a small tape recorder.
No, a small field.
Mm-hmm.
Big tape recorder.
The first Tin Machine album wasn't a commercial success in a way. Were you disappointed by that?
Not at all.
Bitterly.
Bitterly. You cried for weeks, right? You looked like that.
Yeah, we never, in fact, it hurt us so much that we never made another album.
There was some rumors you were doing an album with Nile Rodgers, or had plans for that?
That was a rumor.
Yeah? A rumor.
Smoke gets
in. Maybe you should try to smoke through your nose, and it, like...
I saw Nile last year.
Mm-hmm.
He's very well, thank you.
Okay, well, that's good to hear.
I never miss Nile.
You never do?
I never see him, so I don't miss him.
Okay, we'll see you on stage in a moment. One final question.
Actually, we must point out, Wessel, that after the show, we're auctioning off this table.
That's good.
For the same charity.
Maybe you could also bring a car they can put it in, because it's...
And we're going to sign everything in this room, and we're going to auction off the entire building.
Everything, the body parts of the audience.
All the people.
Yeah.
It's very bratish, isn't it? The whole vibe. But also just them with Reeves and his dildo, or, you know, the peanut butter on the guitar and David, I feel it's very bratish, all of that kind of thing. And I wonder if it was influenced by, you know, the kind of rude boys of the early 90s, like, you know, Guns N' Roses, and the kind of antics that those dudes were getting up to, and the kind of the fag end of glam rock, and, you know, before it went into grunge, the kind of weird tail end of the 80s where people were just sort of being punkish and bratish and anarchic and a bit crap.
Also, bear in mind, I think he was the whole Glass Spider, Never Let Me Down period, which, of course, he would come back to look on as being the Phil Collins years. You know, he was probably quite keen to put some space between Bowie, the global entertainer, and be true to himself as an artist. And maybe part of that was adapting the persona.
There is certainly a sense that there was a kind of a performance, a mask, a kind of in way of engaging with people. And, you know, maybe later in his career, he settled on this more affable Dave sort of, you know, dad joke guy. You know, I love that Bowie of the,
yes,
like, particularly the interviews around the reality
tour. The Jonathan Ross Bowie.
Love that. I love that guy.
Yes.
But, you know, when you go back and look at his, the way that he was with the, with interviewers or just the media in general, you get really different kind of flavors of the guy. Like, I think, you know, it reminds me of that anecdote that Hermione said about how David being just essentially a shy person and using masks and using characters just to feel braver and to be able to sort of front in a situation that's a bit intense. And I think, you know, I can't say that, you know, David wasn't an asshole back then. But I think that there's something about just the being one of the lads in the band, getting up to mischief, being a bit of a brat, was part of like the character as well that he inhabited in the band, this kind of cheeky, mischief, instigator kind of guy that was sort of his role. In that context, some of that stuff, I guess, makes a little bit of sense, but it doesn't make it any less toe-curling and cringy to watch. I mean, it's uncomfortable, particularly like, you know, some of the more misogynistic, condescending things that he would say to women, particularly. Didn't like that.
What makes it worse is that he seems to be either very well tanned or using an alarming amount of fake tan.
But isn't this Mystique tan? Isn't he hanging out in Mystique at this point?
He is. There's a lot of Bali, Mystique. Maybe it's just the TV makeup, but there was the interview I'm talking about where he's on some Dutch pop show. He's Trump, basically. You know, he's literally orange.
And especially when he's wearing that green Mugler suit that just sets the orange off.
I think the green suit is a big part of it. There was a lot of the green suits at that time, wasn't there? His fashion sense was kind of heading the same direction as his general bearing. But okay, so we have this album, which, like you point out, had a very long gestation. It's not currently available, although technically
it's not streaming.
By that yardstick, it's not available. It's definitely not. Why don't we get into it? Let's have a look at the track listing for Tin Machine 2.
Wow, it is a movable feast, isn't it? Although, do we need to give some context to the band?
Hi, I'm Hunt.
Hi, I'm Reeves.
I'm David.
Hi, I'm Tony.
Let's start with the Sales Brothers.
I think they're really interesting, these guys.
Currently residing in the Where Are They Now file.
Yeah.
Where are they now?
No, because they are, I feel, a really crucial element in the success of Iggy's late 70s albums. Mm. You know, the rhythm section of Lust for Life, Passenger, I mean, the drumming and the bass playing, it's legendary. Are also legendary in Tin Machine. And it's one thing that I was struck by listening to this record. Going into it, you know, I was, you know, guarding my heart, ready for the Hunt Sales songs, going, oh my God, these Hunt Sales songs are terrible. But I was surprised, and I'm continually surprised at how kick-ass the drumming and bass playing is across the board on this album. Like, really creative, really interesting, not bog standard. I mean, add Reeves to that with all the craziness he's doing. These guys are a weird band. You know, for as kind of straight and macho and mask and, like, you know, rock and roll they were trying to present themselves. And coming from the 70s, you know, except for Reeves, coming from the 70s, I thought these guys are actually really interesting musicians and really good.
I get a massive difference between those Berlin Iggy albums and the Tin Machine albums, and it's amazing to think it's the same guys doing it.
Yeah.
Primarily Hunt. I think Hunt's work on The Idiot and Lust for Life, I find it far more interesting work. I'm not a big fan of his on the first Tin Machine album. And I think that's also the production as well. But yeah. You feel going in here, there's more of a balance going on with the other elements of the group.
Yeah, and I think some of that is down to Reeves really thickening out the guitar side with loads of experimentation and loads of ambience, but also perhaps need to give props to Tim Palmer, the guy who mixed and produced, well, not produced, but mixed the album. I mean, he's a bit of a legend in sort of early 90s rock. I mean, famously mixed 10 by Pearl Jam. Mm. And if you think about tracks from that album, they're kind of also ambient and big. You think about Alive, you think of sort of, you know, reverb on guitars and huge big drums. And I could hear a bit of that happening in the mixes on Tin Machine 2 as well. Tim Palmer also worked with Gene Loves Jezebel, which I'm trying to do a little tissue of connection here that links to Holy Holy, because James Stevenson plays for Holy Holy and he was in that band. Oh. And so there's always like small music world stories behind everything. And Tim also recently worked with Donnie McCaslin on this Charlie Parker tribute record.
Yes.
So, you know, he's sort of big into jazz now. So in a way, like this character, Tim Palmer, like is really on the edges, fringes of Bowie world.
It's a fascinating character. I looked up his website and I was surprised at how many albums I know and love he's been involved in. You know, again, he's one of those characters that's not perhaps a household name. But go a few albums into your favourites and you'll probably find Tim Palmer there in one way or another.
Yeah, yeah. And I think, you know, when this album hits it hits it really well. And I think that, you know, some of that is down to the way that Tim Palmer actually wrangled out all of these textures together. And it can't be easy mixing 50 layers of Reeves and the drumming of Hunt Sales and Bowie all over the place with his voice. By the way, playing with his voice in new ways on this album that I think are quite exciting. But that's a lot of like tone and texture to try and deal with in a rock context.
And he did the first album, didn't he, Tim Palmer?
Yes.
Yeah, but he was down as producer. Again, like you say, it's a tall order. Another key development that happens here just before the album is he's dropped by EMI.
Oh my God, yeah, that's like a big headline.
That's really big.
First time in his career without a record label since he got signed to one.
Yeah.
Isn't that and crazy?
This is a really big deal. I mean, EMI, I don't know, what was it, $10 million he got in 83 when he signed. And he delivers that massive album. He delivers the massive tour. He delivers a not-so-good album, doesn't tour, delivers a dreadful album, does a mediocre tour. Then he comes back with Tin Machine. EMI, like, all right, David, we have to talk.
We've got to let you go.
So they're left stranded without a record label. Again, to our point about how committed was he to Tin Machine, it's like, well, this kind of underlines that commitment. You know, he didn't row back from Tin Machine and said, okay, you know what? I'll come back and do Let's Dance 2, which he would go and do with Niall anyway. That's the crazy thing, is if he had just said to EMI, give me a second, let me get this second album.
Give me 3 months. I've got something lined up. It's going to be okay. Well, he thought it would be okay.
So we're going in now on some time. What was it? Victory. So this was
Victory music. But this is interesting as well because, you know, when you peek around, there were versions of this album that were shopped to different labels and they had different tracks on them. So there was, you know, It's Tough, which is like a song that probably should have been on the record. It was lost and taken off and, you know, for whatever reason. So Bowie was out trying to farm out some of these songs as publishing for other artists because he offered Mr. Red to Morrissey, who declined it. Really? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I can hear that.
Yeah, I can too. It sounds a little bit like the first song of Foxhole and I.
Oh, My Heart is Full.
Yeah,
yes.
It reminds me a bit of that.
He could bring that wonderful mournful, you know, he could really explore that mournfulness of it, you know, that
could have been
sad.
Interesting.
But I, you know, and also Leah, I didn't realize that he was shopping different versions of this. track listing around to different labels. That's a really fascinating. And again, there must have been a degree of, well, not embarrassment, but it must have been difficult for Bowie to kind of go cap in hand to people and say, here we are.
Yeah, I think it must have been quite humbling for him to have to go through.
It could have been worse. When you read these contemporaneous reviews, they're not blanket dismissal. There are some good reviews.
Yeah, there are some charitable reviews. I wouldn't say there are rave reviews, but there are some really hurtful ones, and particularly the Melody Maker one, you know.
What did that say?
Well, there was the one that was like, "Hot tramp, we loved you so. Now sit down, man. You're an embarrassment."
Because your embarrassment, yeah. Was that Melody Maker?
Yeah. And and that was the journo that said that, was like famously said, you know, he was told that Bowie cried when he read that, and he's sorry that he made Bowie cry, but that he ended Tin Machine was like the good outcome out of it, which I thought was a bit harsh, mate.
That's a bit harsh.
It's a bit harsh.
Imagine being told you made Bowie cry.
Yeah, so he says, "Now sit down, man, you're a fucking disgrace." So he does put the F-bomb in there, which makes it even more savage. There was I think one of the better reviews was like by Vox magazine that just called it passable. Passable, bordering on dull, which is not really what you want, is it? But one last thing we do need to mention before we get into it is the pose that is on the front, the Chrysos Kouros statues.
Mm-hmm.
Are a pose that Bowie was photographed in 1975 in the Steve Shapiro images, you know, where he's got the striped outfit.
Oh, on the back of Station to Station.
Yes. Oh, it was an image associated with Station to Station, and it was an image associated with, you know, drawing the Kabbalah Tree of Life.
Yeah,
And so there's an image of him in that pose with the fists by his thighs and one foot in front of the other. And then that pose is also reprised in the Lazarus video, in the last video we see.
Yes.
He's reprised that same outfit. So it's interesting to see that these are statues that are made for unmarked graves for soldiers, sort of unknown men. Yeah, they're here too. Little fold in time between 1975 and 2016 when we saw the video for the first time.
That is fascinating, that hidden little thread going from 75 to 2016 via Scary Monsters. Do we know anything about the concept of the album? I mean, was this something that came entirely from Edward Bell, or do we think that maybe there'd been some degree of input from Bowie and the band?
I feel Bowie must have had some input into that imagery because he'd quoted it himself. In quite a symbolic way, I felt, with the Shapiro portraits. And, you know, the fact that they're markers for heroes, but also unnamed, you know, sort of they're nameless, could be a nod to the idea of, you know, Bowie heroes, Bowie being a legend, but also anonymous sort of ability to be in a band that's just not very successful, you know, maybe.
Yeah, it's like when Barnbrook did the cover for The Next Day and you're thinking, well, that's not entirely new, is it? You know, he's self-obliterated before. I mean, I remember when it came out, the furore, of course, was the dicks on the cover.
Yeah, that was that. They got censored, right?
In the States, it got censored. I think they just gotten over Diamond Dogs. You know, it took those guys a long time to get over Diamond Dogs. And then just, wouldn't you know it, here come Bowie hitting them with more phallus again.
I mean, let's have a look at these here. I mean, it's clearly sculptured stone. It's not like real cocks or anything. It just seems ridiculous to me.
It is. The US edition then was airbrushed out.
Yeah.
You had these weird kind of sexless, you know, sexless and unaroused, if you will, statues.
Yeah.
Statues there. And then, of course, in the UK, and I'm guessing in the rest of the world, they were, you know, made of sterner stuff.
I feel like I read somewhere that there was an idea for people to buy little stickers with the dicks on.
Oh, I read that. Yes.
And that just to me seems like not very cost effective. Like that would just cost a lot of money to print those stickers.
I know what you mean. I've heard of that. I think it was a throwaway comment that Bowie made in some interview when he was asked about it. And I think he said, probably taking the piss, well, maybe we could have. Can you imagine the record label actually having to send out little stone phalluses
yeah.
so that you can add to your And if you have a CD, you'd be sent like a sort of, you little know, two millimeter
cassette, just really small.
I think they should still do that with the reissue. When our campaign to get Tin Machine 2 reissued comes to fruition, which it will, I think we should definitely invoke that particular idea.
There should be a chased version, just to not upset anybody. And then I want the penis stickers.
The penis stickers, exactly.
To go on top. That's how I want it to be.
And then the whole merch campaign can be designed around the penises. So T-shirts, mugs, pens.
Pens.
Lot. Yeah, everything. I mean, you know, the fun you could have. You know those pens with the
Post-it notes?
The things, you know, when you turn the pen around.
Oh, yeah.
What's that called? Yeah, we'll get one of those as well. Okay, so we're going to do a Tin Machine 2.
We're going to get
campaign.
Into it, yeah.
We'll get that done. Right, so let's begin Baby Universal.
Now that he has no sense of destination, now he's running for the love of speed. When the child goes bad, it's no cause for celebration. Like Timmy Dean, he don't talk back to me. Failures are spirals, mothers to chaos. No, baby, no, baby, no, baby, no.
I think this actually comes from quite early on in Bowie and Reeves' relationship.
So, like those early songwriting sessions where they were throwing ideas around. Yeah, this would have been back then.
Back in the golden days of 1988, when the world was young and exciting.
It's an interesting song. I think it's also one of the really good songs on the album. And I think David knew it because it was like slated to be part of Earthling, right? There was re-recorded.
Have you heard that version?
Yeah, the 97.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it kicks ass.
I hadn't heard it until recently. I love it.
Yeah, it's really good. It does work in that kind of style, that sort of more electronically mediated, harder edge sort of style, like 1997. Yeah.
Now that he has no sense of destination, now he's running for the love of speed. When the child goes bad, no cause for celebration. Like Jimmy Dean, he don't talk back to me. Fingers are spiders, mothers are chaos. No, baby, no, baby, no, baby, no. Hello, humans, can you feel me?
Yeah, so the song had a life. You know, it survived Tin Machine 2, not many of these songs did. You know, which sort of, and the fact that they saved it, or that Reeves and David decided to keep working on it from 1988, speaks to the idea that there's a quality to this song that both of them thought, this is worth it. Let's hang on to this.
We need to take this out of the Tin Machine context and revisit it now. And it's interesting that of all the Tin Machine, the grand canon of Tin Machine, not many songs received any attention after that period was over, did they? But this is one that got the full bells and whistles makeover, the whole treatment.
Yeah,
and
I feel
it's
like
it's a strong song.
This song and I Can't Read were like the ones that that David and Reeves would play live quite often further along in the 90s. I think it's a really great song. I think it's got a really interesting premise, this idea that he's singing from the perspective of some kind of cosmic child, some kind of cosmic god. It makes me think of Stanley Kubrick's Space Odyssey, and you know, their star child at the end, who's kind of born with eyes open and is clearly, you know, juvenile but also somehow fully evolved. This idea of sort of a bratty god, a child gone bad, this idea, you know. Failures as fathers,
this is definitely your Brat Bowie album, isn't it?
I think so, yeah. You know, actually, there's a bratty theme that I think might run through it. I mean, I'm not here saying it's a coherent listening experience, but I do think that there is something about this that is like, a bit childish, a bit puerile, that is like a unifying, could be a unifying sort of theme across all of them. This is the brat era.
Bowie's Brat Summer.
Yeah, it's a this machine is it. Too. Bowie,
I love Baby Universal. I remember, again, when this was released and feeling trepidatious after the release of Tin Machine 1 and, you know, Under the God, which I remember desperately trying to like. This is good. This is good. No, this is good. Under the God. Under the God.
What was your problem with it? Was it too angry?
I think it was just the sledgehammer lyrics, you know, beating all blacks with baseball bats and all that kind of stuff. And it was also the squalliness of it. You know, I mean, remember, I was young. I was quite young. To me, I was young and soft. And to me, Bowie, my first Bowie albums were Pin-Ups and Low, which I bought for 50p each. And so, of course, that's the world I'm going into. And then I got Changes Bowie, which
is a bit of a palate cleanser then.
It's definitely a palate cleanser. I think I just found Under the God to be just too pile driving and very little nuance to it. You know, it was just like...
It's not subtle.
It's not subtle. So this, when Baby Universal comes out, it felt like we were saying earlier about Tim Palmer. There was a structure and space...
Yeah.
To this. And that's an interesting point you make now about 2001. I mean, we know what a colossal impact that movie has had on Bowie throughout his career. And here, again, that all makes sense. You know, this could well be a tip of the hat again to that movie and to those characters.
That's how I read it. But also, I think it vaguely links to sort of the messianic, hubristic themes all the way through his catalogue. Mm. Like, he sings in his subjects about, you know, from Superman to Ziggy Stardust to Atomica, holding himself as a god. This sort of suggestion that these evolved beings are selfish and dangerous and disillusioned and bored.
And that way
they're playthings, or that they just don't care about our suffering. This sort of idea that, you know, the people that we might look to and worship just are indifferent, and the indifference of God, that's a whole thing that goes straight through Heathen and some of the more contemplative works. I mean, I think that there's something here that sort of speaks to a sort of worldview, and sort of David Bowie's kind of way that he sees spirituality, maybe. But yeah, I think, you know, this song sits really nicely in that nest with all those other songs that are about bad gods or dangerously powerful entities that don't care about us.
And I think what really underlines this theory of yours is the title. Baby Universe, Baby Universal. I think this does reach a certain kind of climax on Heathen. But yeah, this is a really intriguing take on it. And of course, you know, he revisits the song, as we're saying. There's clearly something in this that holds sway for him. And it's also just a damn catchy banger.
It's just good-ass song. Oh, there's so many lovely touches to this, which I like. And, you know, Tin Machine 1 is a bit more bare bones, whereas this has got production, which I appreciate.
Oh, totally.
I mean,
the phasing.
Yeah, the phasing, the kind of the voice interjections. In verse 2, there's like 3- and 4-part harmony. It's just, you know, when he says, "Doesn't matter, I've seen everything anyway." And it's like, oh, I live for that bit of production there. That is like gorgeous. And then he breaks into the bridge, you know, "Failure's as father's," the way he screams it. I appreciate that. I appreciate
what is
him
that
going,
lyric?
"Mothers of chaos, failures as fathers."
Mothers of chaos, yeah.
Yes.
What was the next one?
It begins with "failures as fathers."
Failures as fathers, mothers of chaos. No, baby, no, baby, no, baby, no.
It's just the voice that he uses. Yeah. I live. It's like this histrionic coming out. It's so dramatic. It's so camp. It's Bowie. It's Bowieism. You know, this is what I come here for. And so I'm getting delivered the thing that I want, which I love.
And I think we have that amazing palette of voices already being rolled out within the first 4 minutes of the album, which is a fantastic sign, isn't it? You hear this song and you sense that, well, what's going to come next isn't going to be Tin Machine 1.
Yeah, yeah. And we're getting all these lovely characterizations. And also I feel like this song is giving me a little bit of like Hello, Space Boy, because we've got the Hello, yes. They've got the British. We've got like this idea of a speck of dust has settled in my eyes, like moon dust, you know, will cover you. It is echoing forwards in time, which I enjoy now from my perspective looking back. You know, I can see the seeds of something that to me might, you know, become other songs or turn into other ideas in the 90s.
It's definitely a parent or perhaps an uncle to Hello Space Boy. It's an uncle to Hello Space Boy. I that's a really good point.
It's the bratty cousin
to Hello Space Boy. Moving on.
Yeah.
One shot. The Hugh Padgham produced One Shot, or as some critics would unkindly refer to it, One Shit.
Chris O'Leary, when he calls it tepid, sour, corporate rock. I don't agree. I think this is a totally serviceable early 90s rock song. I think it's fine. I don't think it's terrible. I don't think it's shit. I think it's okay. I think it's unchallenging, but on the plus side, it's hugely singable. It's got hooks galore, and I think that's great.
So you feel, yeah, this made a pretty good choice for a single.
I think so.
Yeah.
It's got, I mean, you know, straight away, you've heard the song once or twice. You can sing that chorus and the woo-hoo-hoo, that's great, you know. It's got this swagger to it. It's got this sort of slickness, you know. I could picture some cool chick doing a striptease to it in some kind of bar somewhere. That's what I'm seeing. I'm saying it's heterosexual, this track.
It's very heterosexual, isn't it?
It is.
I'm trying to imagine someone doing a strip to this. I can't.
Just some kind of greasy pole situation.
It's the woo-hoo-hoo bit. Is that twirling a bra over the head or something? Yeah. Woo-woo.
But also it's got a bit of the Joe Cocker baby take off your coat type bass line to it. It's got a bit of you can leave your hat on to it. It's also got a bit of like pump era Aerosmith, like Janie's Got a Gun.
Yes.
It's got a bit of that. And that was like from a few years earlier. So it's, you know, this whole sort of one shot, you know, lovers killing each other with a gun, some kind of passion based murder scenario kind of song. That makes me think of, you know, that kind of era of Aerosmith and, you know.
It's got some really fantastic imageries. Nothing Meant Nothing, $10 tore us apart, one thing led to a dead end, one shot. You know, there's this line, which I'm always wondering about. Looked out on a green world, windows and wives.
Mm.
What is that?
No bedroom to run to.
No miracle jive.
No conversation. Oh, come on, it's a good song.
Yeah, I think it's good. I'm not disputing it. I think it's not. Great. I don't think it's great. There's some greatness missing from it. Yeah. And
that's because it's too heterosexual, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, it's very, very butch.
It's too normative. It's too basic. It hasn't got these layers to it that are juicy that you can pick down into. It's like, oh.
Yeah, that's it. It's the stripper bumping and grinding on the stage with the big woo-hoo-hoos.
Woo-hoo-hoo.
Yeah.
You know what? On the plus side, it has a fantastic guitar solo.
Mm.
Really, really, really good.
I do like this solo. Smashing. It's really well organized, isn't it?
Yeah, it's good structure.
Yeah.
It takes you there. I think it saves the song in a way. Like you kind of like, because once you've heard the verse and you've heard the chorus, he sings the same verse again.
Yeah.
And you're like, but then you get the solo and you're like, okay, now we're going somewhere.
Reeves talks about the solo. They did this with Tim. And Reeves says, I think the solo is better on the Hugh version. But then, you know, there's not a lot between them. He really identifies the only key difference being a hi-hat pattern. between the Padgham version and the Tim Palmer version.
But okay.
Like I was saying earlier, Hunt Sales. We'd already recorded the song and we had two pretty good versions of it in the can when David brought in Hugh Padgham on the third session, which of course ended up being the version. I thought it was totally unnecessary. And besides that, Hugh was a real dick. So not clearly it was like, hey, Hunt, could you do something about that hi-hat pattern? But I listened back to it having read that quote and I can't really tell, you know, I can't, the hi-hat pattern, you know, didn't really.
Yeah, doesn't matter.
Yeah.
It just sounds like, you know, people in a studio like pulling their hair out over a detail that no one cares about.
And you can imagine in this, you know, this fierce democracy of one, basically, but this fierce democracy, everybody just agonizing over these details and the tensions.
Over Hunt Sales' hi-hat
over
pattern.
Over the Hunt Sales and the dramas. And, you know, by all accounts, he was quite a colourful character.
Character.
Yes.
He had flavour, apparently.
He added flavour.
I mean, look, it's not Bowie's finest moment as a lyricist, but I think lyrically, this sort of evocative kind of impressionistic kind of view of a toxic relationship, you know, that's just about tragedy and waste and that's a passionate, cheap, that kind of thing, this sort of, also this uncomfortable theme of violence against women that runs through Bowie's work. Mm. I mean, particularly looking ahead to One Outside, which is, you know,
yes,
a young girl gets mutilated.
Right?
Yeah, yeah. Yes. I think that I'm not saying that this is like a footnote in that storyline. I just think that it belongs as part of that tradition in Bowie's writing.
But again, compare that to the nuance and the depth and complexity of One Outside. I mean, obviously, that's an entirely different beast. It's probably unfair to compare. But the brevity.
Is that mad that he did that, though?
I know.
A couple of years of doing this.
Within a couple of years. But this, the kind of the. I'm lost for words. Rather like Bowie was for this song. Kind of like the casualness of it. That's what, again, it's like something could have gone deeper in here. It's almost like with the man who did Sue.
Yeah. You
know, which yeah. is, again, like a film noir compressed into one song. Here it just seems a bit perfunctory and these lyrics are stems of ideas that don't really get developed and it doesn't really go. But then, who knows? That's the point, isn't it?
One Maybe shot. He was trying to evoke the senselessness of yeah. violence in relationship, in toxic relationships. Maybe it was just about, there was no reason why One Shot put her away. Maybe just it was, they were down to the last $10. I don't know.
Yeah.
It doesn't make much sense, does it? But, you know, I think those gaps usually in Bowie songs lets you fill them in with your imagination, but there's just not enough scaffolding here to make an interesting world.
That's true. Whereas something like Repetition
yes.
sketches using far fewer words, a far more vivid narrative, doesn't it? With Repetition, you have this little, you
it's
know,
much more troubling because you do fill the violence in yourself. Maybe he was going for something like that here and just didn't quite execute it.
Oh, well. Anyway, all right. Not one shit.
I don't think One Shit is shit. I think it's fine. It's not the best song on the album, but it's not the worst by far.
Let's go to one of the finest songs on the album.
This song rules. I think this song rules.
Uh-huh.
This
You're
is
a fan.
Very much my jam. I love it. It is sexy. And it's camp.
Two reflections on the sparkling water. Hand in hand in love with love. That you say, you belong in rock and roll. You belong in rock and roll. You belong in rock and roll. Oh, so do I. I love how she moves.
The voice is so low.
Yeah.
Amazing, but held down so low for so long, just smouldering. But then when you get
it is magnificent. And I think again, you know, this deployment of the voice on Tin Machine 2 is pretty. It's overlooked a lot.
It is. It's actually genuinely thrilling to listen to him singing on this song and on Baby and a few others on this record. But this is thrilling. The way his voice arcs up into flame. Out of the smouldering depths of as low as he can go.
He keeps that growl going for such a long time, doesn't he? You know, it goes, it's deep down at the, must be the very pit of his throat to
it's
get
so
that
low
growl.
He can barely sustain it. Like,
well, it's, I mean, it's been compared to an Elvis type croon, but I think it goes, it's not just a parody of Elvis. It's Bowie doing something that he does really well. You know, like, it's control.
Yeah, and it also has this sinister edge to it. This, it's quite frightening, the kind of grunting that sort of happens, I think.
It's very primal, isn't it?
Yeah. And there's this moment at the end, at the very end, where there's like a kind of aha, but it's like in the distance, and there's like about 50 of him. Just the logistics of producing that would have been like, that would have taken time, but I appreciate that gesture. It's like, you know, this... It's like caps off the whole thing because he starts off with this kind of wormy, deep, sinister, quite creepy voice, and then it arcs up into this, you know, being on fire, on fire, on fire, and then it goes into this lovely sort of solo, and then aha is like how it ends.
An explosive, redemptive, just
gasp. It's wonderful. Yeah. I just think it's such a cool thing. And then there's also the creaky atmospherics, like Reeves's hinge, squeaky hinge sort of sound all the way through it. The drumming, awesome.
Drumming is absolutely brilliant here, isn't it?
Yeah.
Props to Hunt Sales. This is fantastic.
Got to give him his props because we're going to tell him in a few songs' time that he needs to, you know, to rein it back. The drumming is fantastic on this song. The atmosphere is so good. I mean, to me, this production on this doesn't sound dated. It sounds fresh. And I think it's down to the atmospheric layers of Reeves's guitar parts because he's not playing so much guitar as he's playing sound. And it's like, yeah, as I said before, these are rusty hinges, but it's also the dildo vibrator tones that he's getting out of his guitar. And just these like ambient layers and clouds in the background fills out the space with this like deep, bruised sort of color, which I think just everything else sits so well within that soup and it just makes the whole thing work really well.
Sometimes with Reeves, you do get an onslaught of absolute screeching, you know, metal machines colliding, atonal squawking, squonking. You don't.
No.
Here you actually get Reeves at his absolute best. He's an, you know, he creates these, like you say, this wonderful description you just came up with now, like these clouds, these atmospherics that are drifting all the way through this. And I think really everyone's on their A game in this track, you know, whatever this band went through and whatever ups and downs they had, here it all makes sense. You can see now what Bowie was getting at, what they were all getting at with this group, is that when they all play to their strengths and they're listening to each other and they're responding to each other, even though this track came about in a really hopscotch manner, and I think it was pretty much a Reeves creation.
Yeah.
And listeners, if you listen to the Reeves Gabrels episode of Album to Album, you'll get a detailed description. I'm going to do a little, just drop in a little bit now, actually, just so people can hear Reeves when he spoke to me the other year about the making of this track.
Like, You Belong in Rock and Roll just came out as something I was messing around with. And the idea I had that I had a harmonizer that I was writing programs for a company that I had fallen in love with. And it was more than just a harmonizer. It had a lot of other sounds in it, but... it also did a what they call diatonic pitch shift. So you can put any sound into it and tell it what key you want it to make a harmony in and what interval. So I thought, well, what if I put machine noise into that and tell it I want that machine to be in the key of G and to give me the thirds, only thirds on one side and only sevenths on the other. And then I got the idea, well, what if I had a variable speed motor? Because I know motors, when you get near a motor or like a refrigerator or even a TV, with distortion or gain on your pickups, it'll pick up the sound.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it'll go through your amp. Yeah. And it'll go through whatever effects you have. Because I remember years ago with an early form of the harmonizer playing a note or getting ready to start a song with a band I had in Boston. And this was like 85, 80. Standing there waiting for the drummer to count the song in, and we used to rehearse in the kitchen of the house we lived in.
Was that for the sound or just for practical space reasons?
It was because we didn't have a kitchen table, and we set the band up there. Right. I'm standing there waiting for the drummer to count the yeah. song, and he's going, one, two. And the refrigerator came on. The sound of the refrigerator came through my pickups, through my distortion pedal, into my harmonizer,
no way.
And out through my, my speaker cabin. Wow. And it just sounded like, ah! You know, so I remember that, and 5 years later, I asked my tech, you know, do you have like a Dremel or a small drill?
Yeah.
And he goes, well, what do you need? And I said, well, I need a small variable speed motor I can hold in my hand. He goes, you need a vibrator. And I said, well, yeah, that will work, I guess. And he goes, well, there's a sex shop right down the street from where we were in Australia. We're in Sydney, right? So we go down there, and I'm listening to them to hear the key of the motor, you know, where the bass, the root note of the motor is, kind of, and how broad the sweep is. And the guy's looking at me, and they were waiting to close. We got in there right at the end.
Are you going to buy one of those things or not?
Are you just going to? Yeah, exactly. And what's with the...
Why are you listening to them?
And so I picked two that were silver, so they didn't look, they looked more like tools yeah. than marital aids, as they call them, or sex aids. And I'm checking, I'm at the counter, it's just me and a guy cleaning up with a, and in there, and my guitar tech and I. The second employee turns the vacuum cleaner on to start vacuuming the shop, and I hear the motor noise, and I look. And the guy behind behind the counter, the guy behind the counter looks at me and goes, no. So you know. But so I what I did was on You Belong in Rock and Roll is I dialed out the original signal
yeah.
and I went for thirds and sevenths of motor noise held on my pickups. Yeah. That's me turning the motor speed on the vibrator
right.
over my pickups through the harmonizer.
What was that? Lady Finger 4.
I don't know. I was doing some research and I found an interview where he was like name-dropping manufacturers.
Name-dropping his sex shops.
different types that he was like, and explaining that some of them are better for music than others. Well, the solo is amazing, but it's so, to me, the musical thing about this that makes it special is the way that I don't want to be boring with music theory, but something's going on where Reeves and all of his layers are kind of playing like G, a major chord, but Tony is plugging away on an E at the bottom. And what that creates is like a kind of makeshift E minor seventh, but it's not because it's split up between the elements in the band. So it's quite unclear. And it's a lack of clarity as to who's playing what and what's going on, because it's not a cohesive sort of chord. You're not hearing like, oh, that's an E minor or that's a right. G. What you're hearing is a blur between the two, and it's hard to know. And so you've got these like acoustic strums that are all on G, and you've got these lovely sort of tones that are coming out, being pulled out, like almost like orchestral, like from
Is
Reed.
That the whole diddle doo doo doo?
Yeah, well, you've got the kind of jigga-jing, 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 yeah, that kind of yeah. stuff. But then Tony's playing on the E, which is locking it down into a dark place and also suggesting minor on top of everything. And then when you combine that with Bowie's vocal, to me that's like really interesting musically, because it's creating uncertainty and darkness, but also blurring the lines between, am I hearing it right, what's going on? And I think it's super clever. And if that's Reeves' fault, then props to him, because I think it's such a great idea. And it's not the only place on the record where this happens. And I think it's really smart. It's not rock and roll. This is like sort of music composition stuff.
But it is dramatically effective. And I made a note here. I thought you might want to touch on this. So here's what I got. So I thought, well, what if I put machine noise into that, meaning the guitar on this, and tell it I want the machine to be in the key of G and to give me the thirds, only thirds on one side and only sevenths on the other. And then I got the idea, well, what if I had a variable speed motor? Because I know motors, when you get near a motor or like a refrigerator or even a TV with distortion or gain on your pickups, it picks up that sound.
Oh, I like this. So he's got a seventh on top of G, which is giving you an F sharp. But then, of course, we've got E with Tony, so that's giving us an E minor 9. This is really nice. So all of this extra color that's being added in, but in a very subtle way, so it's not overt. It just creates this like really uncertain atmosphere, which I think works so well with the song.
I love that unease in this track. You know, it's a great rock banger, but it's suspended on this very uncertain.
It totally creates tension, and you know, it only kind of releases, you know, in those kind of, you know, on fire when it switches to C, and then you kind of feel stable, and then it goes back to this weird place. And I also have to say that, like, I love Bowie's saxophone. I love his tenor sax on this record. I think it's
the
great
popping sax. Yes,
I like it. Yeah, I think there's a couple of tracks on this album where his sax playing sounds pretty good.
He hadn't been playing sax. When was he playing sax before this? Before Tin Machine 2? When can you remember him playing sax? So he didn't do it in Never Let Me Down. Sax on Tonight?
Did he not?
I don't think so. I could well be wrong, but he's definitely.
It was Borneo Horns, wasn't it?
Borneo Horns is on Tonight, absolutely. Let's Dance, absolutely not.
Not on Scary Monsters.
No, it wasn't Scary Monsters. Would have been on Heroes, probably. When
bloody
he's
hell.
Parping
he
away
dusted
on
it off then, didn't he?
Neukern, yeah.
I mean, I know he played it a lot in Black Tie, White Noise, you know, for better or worse.
Well, this would have primed him for...
Yeah, this is him getting his lip back.
I love this.
He's working on his embouchure.
Yeah. Working on his what?
Embouchure, his lip.
What do you call that? Embouchure? I've never heard that word.
Oh, really? It's like people that play wind instruments have an embouchure. It's the way they hold their mouth. The muscles.
Embouchure.
Yeah.
Embouchure. A bit like ombudsman, but...
It starts with an E, but yeah, it sounds the same.
This was also a single, You Belong in Rock and Roll.
Oh, and the video. We have to talk about the video.
Take it away.
You belong in rock and roll. You belong in rock and roll. You belong in rock and roll. So do I. I love how she moves me. It makes me feel alright, 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 alright.
It's just so gay.
Take it away while I try
it's
to
so
remember.
So gay and hot. It's gay and hot is what it is. They're in this weird room that's being surveilled by eyeballs through artworks and cameras. And Bowie's wearing a bandage around his leg and he's very tan. And that's because he just got his tattoo on his, you know, his dolphin tattoo, the one with the serenity prayer.
Yeah.
So he'd obviously met Iman and they've had the little connection about a grave for a dolphin and all that. And then Bowie then has these wonderful shots of him in his green Mugler suit holding the mirrored guitar and he's singing to the camera through the reflection of the mirrored guitar. And then there's another one where he's lots of mirrors, lots of preening in front of mirrors. That's happening. There's a lot of that going
on.
We have
the green Mugler suit.
Yes, we do.
Okay.
That's a really important part. And he's very tan. He's got lots of makeup on.
Yeah.
And it's super, super hot and super gay. Because there's this point where I think he sings the words, I love how she moves me.
Yes.
Oh, no, he sings Alone on a Mean Street and he flashes this, like, camp look to the mirror and it's in that moment you can see Ziggy Stardust. It's like this flash of Ziggy and I often, like, freeze frame it and just admire it because it's him from the 70s, you know? It's that guy. You're like, oh, Jesus, that's him. And then at the end of the video, how can you forget this? He starts, like... licking this mannequin's toes. And he also does this thing where he tries to take the eye contacts out with tweezers, but he can't do it. It's like, I think, a reference to...
Man Fell to Earth.
Yes.
When I remember this song, I just remember a Top of the Pops appearance. I'm going to check this out as soon as we're done talking
to
today.
I'm going to check it out.
Because
I think it's a good song.
It only compounds the mystery then of why this song was a flop commercially, because if that was really the video... How on earth could the UK and US pop charts have resisted?
Yeah. It could have been the toes at the end that just pushed them over. It could have been.
That pushed them over and just led the public to think, absolutely not, David.
Yeah, David's
It could have been. I mean, we're talking about this amazing degree of innovation, harmonic genius, avant-garde movie making. And what do they do with it? They have to go on Wogan on 7 o'clock on BBC One to promote it. And of course he's pissed. Of course he's not going
to
be
happy. And he had to lip sync. He wasn't happy.
He had to lip sync. And there's that quote from Terry Wogan, which said, David Bowie would not speak, or at least not sensibly, and would not allow his backing group to talk. Do you notice that? His backing group.
His backing group, to talk either.
He will never know how close he came to a slap on live television. Nice old Terry Wogan. On Top of the Pops, I'm going to play now another clip from Reeves talking about the time he was banned from taking his beloved vibrator on Top of the Pops. Here's what he did instead.
They wouldn't let me use it on Top of the Pops.
Right. Didn't you use something else?
I used an eclair, because they wouldn't let me use it because they thought it was obscene.
Yeah.
And we were miming anyway, which I hated doing Top of the Pops for that reason. I think I played it years later on Earthling. I think I wore my guitar left-handed or something on one of the times. On the other hand, it's nice to know that I'd done it enough times that I can't remember what I did. So the eclair, Andy Spray, my guitar tech, put it in a little box or in a box on top of my amp. I said, put it on the box. So he got it from somewhere, put it on a box on top of my amp, and he even painted the box black so no one would notice it, you know. And when it came time for the solo, instead of reaching over for the vibrator, I reached over for the eclair, and I just wiped it up and down the neck of my guitar. And I was using this completely chromed Steinberger. So it was just this shining, gleaming metal guitar-looking guitar. And but what I did at the end of it, for the course of the solo, I just smeared it up and down the strings. And at the very end, I wiper-bladed it off the strings. And in the original Top of the Pops episode, I think they re-edited it after the fact, but I wiper bladed it and it shot off the neck and went right onto the camera lens.
Wow.
So it was the money shot, basically. And so you want something that's not obscene?
Oh, that's brilliant.
I think they also threw one of our bass tech out that day because he moved a cable that was laying across that someone dropped on the bass player's pedals.
Leah, did you, in your musical appreciation of You Belong in Rock and Roll, did eclairs figure anywhere in there?
No, but maybe they could.
Maybe they could.
I've got room to appreciate more about this song.
Yeah, I think there's a lot more. I've certainly got a lot more room to appreciate about this song because I'm going to go and hunt out this video.
Oh, mate, you're in for a treat.
Right, moving on.
I would do anything for you. I would come all day. I would swim all the ocean's blood.
Is it a good cover? No. Mm. Should it exist? Probably not.
I really like this.
You do?
Yeah. I didn't know the Roxy Music song before I got Reeves Gabrel's favourite Sin Machine album, Oy Vey Baby. true fact.
Let's park that somewhere.
That is Reeves Gabrel's favorite David Bowie. Sorry, that is Reeves Gabrel's favorite Tin Machine album. His logic is it's kind of midway between the two, and it's the band On Fire, On Fire, On Fire, On Fire, and at the heart of the album is like a 29-year-long version of If There Is Something, and it's a great song. And I'd just never heard the song before.
Oh.
So, of course, I heard it on that album and I had just moved to Dubai and I'd only taken a few CDs with me. And one of them, for some reason, was Oy Vey Baby. And I just remember being on my own. The company I was working for had put me up in service departments in the middle of downtown Dubai, which was pretty much, it wasn't the glam part of Dubai. It was just a really dismal kind of suburban area. And I remember just going to the supermarkets on Saturdays, walking around with my Discman and listening to Oy Vey Baby really loudly in this very alien environment. And this particular track, I was blasting as I was looking at the fruit and veg, and somebody, like a store attendant, came up to me, this little guy, and tapped me. And I said, what? He goes, your volume is too loud. It is not good for you.
Maybe it was that, you know, when Bowie got to the bit like, your love, that bit in the middle there.
It was escaping
your headphones because it was must so powerful.
But I was getting so into it. And I thought, wow, this is a great song. This is a fantastic song now. You know,
but isn't there a point where, like, once the song's been going for like 12 minutes, 20 minutes, I mean, it becomes Stockholm Syndrome after a while. You're like, you've got no choice. You have to enjoy it.
You do,
you're stuck inside the experience.
I get it. Now I know the Roxy original. I see what the criticisms are, because the Roxy original is so deliciously bonkers, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, it's just like the textures, the instruments, the weird shifts from kind of country to...
It's doing a lot with genre and style. Yeah.
It's completely barking mad. And Ferry just sounds, you know, he's warbling. He's got that kind of shrill warbling thing going on in his voice, which is wonderful.
Yes.
And of course, you don't get that here.
Well, he tries. Doesn't David try when he says your love? You know, there's that bit in... Because they've taken the word love and they've put it through like acres of reverb to try and make it go on forever, right?
Mm.
I think it doesn't... I mean, it's like when again, I'm sorry to keep bringing up Tonight, but when we talked about Tonight, Nick Pegg, as you know, is incredibly mature and forgiving, and he's a very, you know, he doesn't
he's
go
measured.
In for... He's measured. That's the word. That's the word I was looking for. He's measured. And I spend a lot of time critiquing, to put it politely, God only knows. And even Nick was just like, why? Why? Why is he doing this? Because he massacres, God only knows, for no good reason. There is no good reason for...
Well, see, look, listen, we're sitting on two sides of the dining table here, because I don't mind God Only Knows.
Oh, dear.
I enjoy listening to it, whereas this one I have trouble with, because I just don't see the point of it. I'm not sure what it's doing. And I know that's rich. That's very hypocritical
someone. Not at all. But I'm genuinely intrigued. How do you see God Only Knows as being a worthy cover version and this not?
Because I think I enjoy the vocalism of God Only Knows. It sounds so batshit crazy. And he's swinging for the rafters with his voice for no reason. And it just gets higher and higher and higher and crazier and crazier and crazier. And I'm so happy that it exists, because it's just so funny. And when you listen to it, because it's such a sweet song, the original one.
Yeah, the original
one. And
what
he's done to it, he's monsterized it. And it's just become this vocal exercise in, like, you know, bel canto opera or something. It's surreal. It's like Salvador Dali wouldn't have thought of it. I see it.
I'm with you on that 100%. It is a work of surrealism. It's his and Xi'an Andalou, isn't it? It's complete surrealism. But I just feel
it's anguish as well. Like, it's like he's tearing his clothes off, you know, just God only knows what up. It's like, oh, I can't get enough of it. I love it.
Okay, I mean, I could see an argument for it being in the same kind of lineage as Across the Universe, which gets a similar kind of histrionic treatment. But I think there he's on the right side, of maybe because Lennon was hovering around and he didn't want to kind of, you know, piss off Lennon, or he was just... But we all know in what awe he had for Lennon, you know, how much awe he had for Lennon, how much respect he had for him. So I don't think he would have deliberately driven a coach and horses through Across the Universe. But here...
But Bowie's covers are, you know, what, hit and miss at best. You know, you think about the questions you have to ask about any cover version is like, what is it doing?
Yeah.
How does it, you know, not necessarily how does it stack up against the original, but like, why bother? What is it doing? And sometimes you can't answer that question with David's covers. I'm thinking about, like, you know, from Bruce Springsteen to God Only Knows, up to even the Beatles cover to the George Harrison cover later on. It's a struggle bus sometimes to get on board with the cover versions. But every now and then there's a good one, like Kingdom Come or Criminal World. I dig that. But yeah, it's tough. Speaking of it's tough, I would have preferred It's Tough here instead of this.
You think, really?
Yeah, I would have. I would have preferred it.
Okay, I got to say, while I do enjoy, I enjoy the live version. I enjoy that long stretch out, you know, elasticated, if there is something on Oy Vey Baby. Here, the album version, to me, it's not as good as that. It's not as good as the Oy Vey Baby.
I'll give you that. I think the Oy Vey Baby one, it makes more of a mountain out of this well, than it is here.
If I can just pick you up on that, this was recorded at Mountain Studios.
Oh, yeah.
Hey, there you go. You see? You see, we're cooking on gas now.
Wasn't it? Some of it was recorded in Australia. I'm going to take that.
Was some of this recorded in Australia?
No, I don't think this was. No, but the album.
Yeah, some of it. Yeah. I think I read somewhere that pretty much the bulk of it was done there. Maybe Chris O'Leary said that.
But Sketched out a lot of this stuff, but I think the overdubs and some of the vocals were done elsewhere and in LA and, you know, all over, right?
So I read a quote from himself, from Bowie, saying the Roxy Music track was done for the first album, the second track we made, and we included it here to show the cohesiveness of what we were doing then and now. We did it because after Heaven's in Here, we were so exhausted that we didn't have it in us to write another song. So we used an old song to show how we as a band would approach someone else's material. We also did Working Class Hero on the first album. When we were mixing this album, I remembered we'd done the Roxy song. So we pulled it out to see how it sounded and we really got off on it.
We got off on it.
Yeah, so it seems kind of, yeah, weird, you know, like, all right.
Let's... The quality about this, like what is the song doing? I just think it's a bit dumb. Like, I think dumbness is a theme on this album. It's a bit dumb. It's just a bit knuckleheaded, you know. It sounds a bit knuckleheaded. It doesn't sound, you know, clever or self-referential or doing interesting things with style. It's just, they're just bashing the song out.
Well, pretty much everything that gets passed through the Tin Machine filter is going to have those quirks and curlicues ironed out, isn't it? You know, everything's going to be kind of processed through that mincer and come out
hamburger like meat.
Yeah. As hamburger. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But isn't it weird
they hamburgerized Roxy Music with this?
It's gone from the fine filet of Roxy Music to the hamburger mince of Tin Machine. But it's funny what you say. I mean, it's true also, I think that's also very true of Working Class Hero, which at the way Lennon does it as a kind of bleak northern folk ballad, you know, just that dry brushed acoustic back and forth, and the way he's singing is very much like an old 19th century northern folk ballad. And then of course here's like, as soon as you're born they make you feel small. Like, give it, you know, and it just gets sort of,
it's
again,
not very
just,
elegant, is it?
It's not elegant, and again that kind of that depth of emotion is gone,
yeah,
and it becomes like, you know, like a pub band.
It's knuckleheaded, which I think is a quality that is, you know, something on this Tin Machine 2 album, which comes back and back again, you know.
If there is something that I might find, look around corners, try to find peace of mind. I say, where will you go if you and me try to keep a straight course? Somebody special looking at me, same kind of reaction.
And that was Leah Cardos in conversation with me about Tin Machine 2. And I really hope that you've enjoyed this, the first part of this series, which will be raking over the gnarly roots of the album. Stay tuned for the next installment, and also coming soon, a special episode featuring someone who was there. All will be revealed. So, till next time, thank you for listening. Please share, review, comment, like, subscribe, whatever works best for you. And I will be back in one shot, I guess. Thanks, and bye for now.